It is important for us, my brothers, that we exterminate from our lands this nation which seeks only to destroy us. You see as well as I that we can no longer supply our needs, as we have done from our brothers, the French. Therefore, my brothers, we must all swear their destruction and wait no longer. Nothing prevents us, they are few in numbers, and we can accomplish it.
By the fall of 1760, the French and Indian War was now over, but the North American frontier was about to yet again explode in a wave of violence. By September of 1760, the French and Indian War was over, and the French had been defeated. The citizens of Boston would celebrate with a day of Thanksgiving. Boston newspapers recount how the occasion was celebrated with parade, a grand dinner, music, bonfires, and the firing of cannons. The Reverend Thomas Foxcroft of the First Church in Boston offered thus: "The Lord hath done great things for us, wherefore we are glad. Long had it been the common opinion, Delendus est Carthago, Canada must be conquered, or we could hope for no lasting quiet in these parts. And now, through the good hand of our God upon us, we see the happy day of its accomplishment. We behold His Majesty's victorious troops treading upon the high places of the enemy, their last fortress delivered up, and the whole country surrendered to the King of Britain in the person of his general, the intrepid, the serene, the successful Amherst." Amherst was rewarded plenty for his victory over the French and Indian War. He was made Governor General of the British in North America in September, and in honor of his victory later that year, he was elevated to Major General. The next spring, in April, he was made a Knight of the Order of the Bath. Amherst, from his base of operations in New York, would oversee a contingent of regulars, still fighting the Seven Years' War in the Caribbean. And with his command in North America, forces under General Amherst immediately began work to consolidate the new territories now under British possession. Those being Canada and territories to the west, known as the Pays d'Enhaut, or the Upper Country. This area included portions of modern-day Michigan, Ontario, Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois. And it was mostly occupied by French allied tribes. Though the British made peace with many tribes in the Great Lakes area, as well as those in Ohio and Illinois, the relationship remained pretty tense, and Jeffrey Amherst was about to make life for the natives a whole lot harder. As the new commander-in-chief in North America, General Amherst was in charge of implementing policy towards the Native Americans, which included military concerns and regulations on the fur trade. Amherst thought that the Indians would have been willing to submit to British authority as long as France was eliminated from the equation. Furthermore, he thought that the natives were unable to provide the British Army with any really meaningful resistance. And as a result, only roughly 500 of the 8,000 soldiers under his command in North America were actually even positioned in the area where the soon-to-be rebellion would break out. Natives who were participating in the rebellion often claimed that the British really treated them no better than dogs or slaves. And Amherst, as well as other officers like Major Henry Gladwin, the commander at Fort Detroit, made really no attempt to hide their disdain for the indigenous peoples. And when we're talking about this area where Pontiac's War breaks out, we're really talking about three groups of indigenous people. See, the upper country in New France was really ill-defined, and the inhabitants of that region were from several different and distinct cultural tribes. See, rather than centralized political authorities, these tribes were linguistic or more ethnic groups. No tribe was totally unified, and no single chief really spoke for the whole tribe. So the Ottawas, for instance, did not really fight as a tribe. Rather, some of its leaders elected to fight, while others chose to oppose the war and avoid involvement in it completely. You even had some tribes split over who they allied with. For instance, you had the Canadian Mohawks allying themselves with the French, and the New York Mohawks allying themselves with the English. Now, when we're talking about this area, the first group of tribes would really consist from the Great Lakes. Those would include the Hurons, who spoke more of an Iroquois language, and the Ottawas, Ojibwas, and Potawatomis, who spoke more Algonquin languages. They had lived, traded, and intermarried quite frequently with the French, and they had been doing so for a considerable amount of time. As such, they really were lifelong allies of France. So after the French loses control in North America, the Great Lake Indians were shocked to discover that they were now under their enemies, the British. When a British garrison took possession of Fort Detroit from the French in 1760, local natives cautioned them that, quote, "this country was given by God to the Indians." When the first Englishmen reached Fort Michilimackinac, Ojibwa chief Minavavana told him, quote, "Englishmen, although you have conquered the French, you have not yet conquered us." Another group was the tribes from the eastern Illinois country, such as the Miamis, the Kickapoos, the Piankashawas, to name a few. These people really shared a long history of close contact with the French, much like the tribes in the Great Lakes. But unlike the Great Lakes, these tribes were more on the western frontier of the struggle. And the Brits really were unable to get any military might into Illinois during the whole French and Indian War. So the tribes in that region really were the last to accept any sort of British possession over their lands. The Lenape, or the Delaware, or the Shawnees, and the Mingos made of the third group of tribes in the Ohio country. Earlier in the century, these people moved into the Ohio Valley in order to flee the Iroquois, British, and French oppression. Ohio tribes, though they had fought as French allies in the last war to drive out the British, had no real strong allegiance to the French, unlike their counterparts in the Great Lakes and Illinois. They would agree to a separate peace with the British in exchange for the British Army to leave. However, rather than pulling out of their forts when the French left, the British negated that treaty by fortifying more forts in the region. Even though Pontiac's War really doesn't start until 1763, British officials had been warned as early as 1761 how angry the American Indians were, and that they were preparing for an assault. Senecas from the Ohio country began distributing wampum, with messages urging the tribes to unite and expel the British. Gayasuda and Tejedores, leaders of the Seneca, were worried about being surrounded by British forts. Similar, wampum emerged in the Illinois County and in Detroit. See, due to the lack of unity among Native Americans, other natives told the British commander about the Seneca plot in June of 1761, while they were in Detroit. William Johnson held a large-scale council with the tribes in September of 1761 in Detroit, hoping to squash the distribution of wampum and bring about a bit of a precarious truce. In reality, I think Jeffrey Amherst summed up British attitudes towards Native Americans the best when he wrote of the Native Americans, quote, the vilest race of being that ever infested the earth. And he was, quote, fully convinced the only true method of treating those Indians is to keep them in proper subjugation, end quote. Amherst would put forth a number of policies that really suppressed Native Americans. He would end the custom of gift exchanging, a sign of goodwill within Native American culture, and really work to impose severe restrictions on trade, including the ban of guns and ammunition. Such actions actually reinforced Native American fears stroked by the French earlier, who were now retreating from America, which many anxious Native Americans perceived as leaving the British with really no means of restraint of their power or expansion. Simultaneously, a significant philosophical movement among the Native Americans was taking root, spurred on by the Delaware prophet, Newlin. This movement emphasized moral advancement and self-sufficiency through distancing oneself from European, primarily British, commodities. Really a call back to their native roots. Additionally, Newlin demanded that the British, whom he derided as, quote, dogs clothed in red, be driven from their native lands. Inspired by Newlin's vision and hoping for the return of the French, Pontiac besieged the British fort at Detroit on May 7th, 1763, setting off a war. Approximately 300 soldiers wearing concealed weapons infiltrated Fort Detroit with Pontiac in an attempt to ambush the fortification. Nonetheless, the British were prepared and had heard of his scheme. Having failed in his plan, Pontiac withdrew following a quick council and besieged the fort 2 days later. He slaughtered British soldiers and English settlers, including women and children, who he and his warriors discovered outside the fort. As was customary in some Great Lake Indian societies, they actually ceremoniously cannibalized one of the English soldiers. And their goal was really targeted towards the British and American colonists, as they had mostly ignored any French colonists still in the region. Eventually, the siege would be joined by around 900 warriors from nearly half a dozen different tribes. When Pontiac sieged Fort Detroit, other natives attacked in the region. Colonists in western Pennsylvania right around this time would run to Fort Pitt for refuge. Inside the fort were close to 550 people, around 200 of whom were women and children. The fort's commander, Simon... How do you say that guy's name? Simon...
Aquire, the Swiss-born British...
Simon Aquire. Okay. Simon Aquire, the Swiss-born British commander in charge of the fort, wrote that, quote, "We are so crowded in the fort that I fear disease. The smallpox is among us." On June 22, 1763, Delaware and other attackers besieged the fort and held it throughout July. Concurrently, war groups from Delaware and Shawnee invaded Pennsylvania, capturing prisoners and slaying an unknown number of colonists. Smaller fortresses that connected Fort Pitt to the east, Fort Bedford, and Fort Ligonier were occasionally fired upon by natives, but they were never captured. To Colonel Henry Bouquet, who was prepared to lead an expedition to relieve Fort Pitt, Amherst wrote on June 29, 1763, quote, "Could it not be contrived to send the smallpox among the disaffected tribes of Indians? We must on this occasion use every stratagem in our power to reduce them." Bouquet responded that he would try to spread smallpox to the Indians by giving them blankets that had been exposed to the disease. Amherst replied back to Bouquet, fully endorsing the plan. However, officers at Fort Pitt had already attempted what Amherst and Bouquet were discussing, presumably without their orders. In an attempt to infect the natives and break the siege, Captain Aquire brought two blankets and a handkerchief that had come in contact with smallpox to delegates of the besieging Delaware during a parley at Fort Pitt on June 24th. William Trent, the fort's militia commander, wrote in his journal, quote, "We gave them two blankets and a handkerchief out of the smallpox hospital. I hope it will have the desired effect," end quote. Trent then submitted an invoice to the British Army, writing that the items had been, quote, "taken from people in the hospital to convey the smallpox to the Indians," end quote. The expanse was approved by Esquire and ultimately by General Thomas Gage, who would succeed Amherst. Meanwhile, at Fort Detroit, upon obtaining additional forces, the British would attempt to launch an unexpected assault on Pontiac's camp. Pontiac was prepared, however, and on July 31st, 1763, he defeated them at the Battle of Bloody Run. Pontiac's power, though, among his supporters started to decline while the situation at Fort Detroit remained essentially at a standstill. Many native warriors started to pull out of the siege in groups. Some of them even made peace with the British before they left. Convinced that the French now would not support him at Detroit, Pontiac lifted the siege on October 31st, 1763, and withdrew to the Maumee River, where he carried out organizing opposition to the British. Even as the rebellion was dying out, many Pennsylvanians became convinced that their government was actually not doing enough to protect them from the bloodshed and the fear of Pontiac's war. The most severe manifestation of this dissatisfaction was an uprising spearheaded by a vigilante group known as the Paxton Boys, so named because the majority of them were from the Pennsylvania village of Paxton. The Paxton Boys directed their ire at the Moravian, Lenape, and Mohicans, as well as the Susquehannock, who coexisted rather peacefully in a very small community close to white Pennsylvania towns. A gang of at least 50 Paxton Boys traveled to the Susquehannock village of Conestoga on December 14, 1763. After they got word of reports of a raiding expedition, when they got there, they killed the 6 people that they found. The remaining 14 Susquehannock were put in protective custody in Lancaster by Pennsylvanian officials. But on December 27th, the Paxton Boys broke into the workhouse and slaughtered them. While the ringleaders received bounties from Governor John Penn, none of the Paxton Boys were ever taken into custody. Next, the Paxton Boys turned their attention to the Mohican and Lenape, who had been transported to Philadelphia for their safety. In February of 1764, some 100 supporters of the Paxton Boys marched on Philadelphia. However, the presence of British troops and the militia, the Philadelphia Associators, deterred them from carrying out more acts of violence. The issue was resolved, though, by Benjamin Franklin, who had assisted in planning the defense, negotiating with the Paxton leaders. Franklin then released a harsh critique of the Paxton Boys, saying, quote, "If an Indian injures me, does it follow that I may revenge that injury on all Indians?" In the spring and summer of 1764, there was an increase in native raids on frontier settlements. Virginia was the colony most severely harmed, with over 100 citizens killed. 15 colonists were slain in May in Maryland while laboring in a field close to Fort Cumberland. And about 13 residents were slaughtered and their homes were set on fire in June in the Pennsylvania area of Fort Loudoun. The most infamous raid would take place in what is now Franklin County, Pennsylvania, when in July, 4 Delaware warriors slaughtered and scalped 10 school children and their school teacher. This incited the Pennsylvania Assembly to reinstate the French and Indian War scalp bounties, which gave compensation for any enemy native killed over the age of 10. With all of this going on, the Board of Trade held General Amherst accountable for the rebellion and recalled him to London in August of 1763, replacing him with Major General Thomas Gage. Gage would dispatch two expeditions into the West in 1764 in an effort to put an end to the rebellion. Hopefully they would free British captives and apprehend any natives who had started the conflict. Historian Fred Anderson claims that because Gage's campaign, which really was Amherst's plan, was centered on punishing the Indians rather than putting an end to the conflict, it dragged on for more than a year. Gage deviated, though, significantly from Amherst's plan by permitting William Johnson to negotiate a peace treaty at Niagara, so providing the natives with the chance to, quote, bury the hatchet. The war really was only brought to an end in early 1765 when the French really failed to aid the natives with anything. That and the prospect of the now larger Iroquois Confederacy intervening on the English's behalf, and more importantly, promises by English authority to conform to native understandings of their alliances and recognize indigenous sovereignty. There were numerous outcomes from Pontiac's rebellion. Most importantly, the battle forced the British to reconsider their Indian affairs and concede to native requests out of concern for continuing warfare, which allowed Native Americans to continue playing a significant role in North American geopolitics during the 18th century. In a similar vein, it also showcased one of the best instances of Native American opposition to colonialism and set the stage for later Native American movements such as the Northwest Confederacy and the alliance between Tecumseh and Tenskwatawa in the early 1800s. There were more unforeseen effects, though, to the conflict. American settlers were the ones who really suffered the most from the violence. Historians also believe that over 500 American colonists had died. During and after the conflict, indiscriminate attacks against Native populations were sparked as justification for this trauma. In addition, colonists vented their resentment at the British Empire for taking action to protect Native sovereignty, such as enforcing the Proclamation Line of 1763. All of these factors would be another reason leading to a revolutionary storm developing between 1763 and 1775.